This is Talk Radio 680 WCBM. Time now for Money, Riches, and Wealth. Here's your host, Drew Tignanelli.
Oh, there I am. Oh, I wasn't ready there, Chris. And this is Drew Tignanelli. And we're here with Money, Riches, and Wealth, and with Christopher O'Shea. How you doing, Chris?
Great, sir. It's great to be with you. Great to be inside on a dry, in here where it's dry on a rainy night.
That's good. And why don't you tell everybody who our guest is tonight, because we do have a guest tonight.
We do. And his name is David Pilling, and he's an associate editor at the Financial Times, where he has reported on business, economics, and politics from London, Chile, Argentina, Tokyo, and Hong Kong. He is currently the Africa editor based in London. So he's written a book that we're looking at tonight called The Growth Delusion, Wealth, Poverty, and the Well-Being of Nations. So not a small topic.
Not a small topic, and not one that is specific, you know, for our listeners about investments or general financial planning like we typically do. But this is an important topic to understand how gross domestic product is generated, and are there flaws in it? Because as an investor, you need to understand what's going on in the economy. So that's why I find this interesting.
Yeah, because it's talked about so often. You hear about that, GDP growth, GDP growth.
Yeah. So, David, why don't you just start off with telling us why you think it's important that we measure GDP properly? Are you there, David? Oh, there he is. He's coming on. All right, there he is. David, now you get to talk. Go ahead, David.
So GDP was, invented in the 1930s. People think that when we talk about, the economy, when we talk about growth, when we talk about gross domestic product, we're measuring something like the mass of a mountain or the speed of a car, something that, that we can all agree on. But I guess it's my contention that the GDP is an invention. It's a man-made invention. It wasn't around until the 1930s. And that to some extent, it's out of date. It came out of a specific time. It was invented during the Great Depression. It was consolidated during the run-up to the Second World War. And it's very much a child of the manufacturing age. And I think that it's, to some extent, it's out of date. And yet we take this number extraordinarily seriously. We talk about it all the time. We follow GDP every quarter. Minor improvements in GDP we take extraordinarily seriously. The stock market goes up. We get very excited. Tiny little setbacks, we get very depressed. And yet I think that we put too much store in this number. So I wrote a book just looking at what is in this number, what is not in this number, and how we might think about our economy slightly differently.
Yeah, it's interesting, Simon Kuznets, right? Is the one that was basically considered the father of the GDP. And like a lot of things, after he got it going and everybody started, it all of a sudden took a life of its own and started going in a direction. He was kind of depressed as to where he saw it end up in the later years of his life.
Well, that's exactly right. I mean, I called that a particular chapter in my book kind of Frankenstein's monster. And Kuznets came out with this number, or the kind of forerunner of this number, in 1934. He was really asked by FDR to come up with a way of measuring the economy, because it's hard to believe now, but until he came out with a paper in 1934, there was no real way of measuring the economy, not any way to consolidate it into one single number. FDR had numbers like freight car loadings, the stock market was in a bad way, unemployment was high, but there was no single number that said what the economy was doing. So Kuznets came up with this number, and he found in his paper that the economy had halved between 1929 and 1933. This was an enormously important number. In fact, GDP was called one of the great inventions of the 20th century, and I don't actually take issue with that. But even as this number was, in a sense, taking form, being given birth to, Kuznets had a number of warnings. One of the warnings was, do not confuse this number with well-being. This number does not tell you about the well-being of society. A second warning of Kuznets was, don't just look at the headline number. Peer within it. Look at some of the numbers that are beneath it. So, for example, during the in the fallout after the Wall Street crash, Prisnet discovered that the wealthy did a lot better off than the poor. So the poor suffered a lot more in the 3 or 4 years after the Wall Street crash than did wealthier people who had assets. And he said that's a significant finding. So don't just look at the headline number.
Yeah.
And finally, Kuznets actually wanted to take things off GDP. He wanted to take things off like armaments because he thought that armaments were not necessarily, you know, for the benefit of humankind. He wanted to take off financial speculation, something that we might consider quite prescient.
So you know, you're bringing up a very good point too, and that is that, and this is something that we can talk about as we come back from our first pause, which we have to take in about 30 seconds or so.
Yep.
But what you're bringing up is that every country in the world uses different things to measure their GDP, don't they?
Well, that's exactly right. I mean, for example, in Britain, we count prostitution and hard drugs like heroin.
Well, that's probably says something more about England than it does about GDP, though, doesn't it?
Well,
there,
it might do. It was actually a decision by the European Union.
Now that really makes sense now.
Well, and in all that, though, when you measure this, is that it then causes decisions to be made, allocation of resources, what have you. So I think there's a lot to talk about.
So we got to get to the traffic, and then we're going to talk about prostitution and drugs in England.
Might, I'm not,
All right. Something to look forward to.
That's true. Hold on, David. We're going to go to traffic. We'll be right back. Money, Riches, and Wealth.
This is Drew Tignanelli, host of Money, Riches, and Wealth, and president of the Financial Consulate. This is for business owners and presidents of companies listening today. If you have a 401k in your company, then let me warn you that lawyers are hunting for you with good reason. 401k plans with less than 1,000 employees have been built around revenue sharing, or in my words, commissions. The Department of Labor has opened a door for lawyers to sue you on behalf of employees unhappy with excessive fees in the plan. They are correct, but the funny thing is, the business owner has normally the majority of the money in the plan. You need a great plan for you and your employees, for everyone's retirement is dependent on it. We do a 401k review of your plan to help determine how to develop the best possible commission-free plan and keep the plan current. Call 410-823-SAVE, that's 410-823-SAVE, to schedule your 401k review. Everyone's retirement is dependent on it, so call 410-823-SAVE.
All right, we're back, Money, Riches, and Wealth. I guess that was Sly and the Family Stone. Nope. All right. I'm getting closer every time. Anyway, we're here with David Pilling, and we're talking about the growth delusion. He's talking about how they measure GDP. And so one of the things that's interesting, David, is that, you know, like you had a famous economist come out about 5 years or so ago that says when your debt to GDP gets over 100%, you're going to start having trouble in the economy. And, you know, so everybody's looking at all this and so forth. And yet Japan's 250, 270 debt to GDP right now. The U.S. is somewhere anywhere between 80 and 110, depending on how you want to measure their debt to GDP and so forth. But you're saying that this GDP number is sort of, you know, unique to each country, and we're looking at apples and oranges a lot of times.
To some extent, yeah. I mean, look, I wouldn't want to exaggerate. I mean, GDP is a standard measure that goes across nations, and it has a meaning. But let me give you an example. So Nigerians woke up one day to find that their GDP had gone up 89%. The reason was they just sort of slightly tweaked the methodology for how to calculate it. So as a result, their debt-to-GDP ratio collapsed, which was good for Nigeria because they could borrow more, they could borrow more cheaply. The Italians once woke up to find that their economy had just got bigger than the British economy.
The Italians are good at that.
Yeah, they began to measure their grey economy more accurately. For the grey economy, we might be able to say the mafia. And suddenly, they were bigger than Britain, and there was a big celebration in Italy called Il Topazzo.
Right. Now, remember, David.
So,
Remember what my last name is. My last name is Tignanelli. So be careful when you're starting to talk about the Italians like this, okay? But go ahead. Tell us a little more about that.
All right. I'm taking notes. You know, they were measuring the gray economy, and when you measure stuff that's outside the taxed economy, you know, you're moving closer towards a guess. Now, I'm not saying that GDP is a useless number. I'm not saying that that it means nothing. But I am saying that we need to be a little more wary about taking it so seriously. And after all, you know, our politicians, they talk about the economy as though it's this very fixed thing. If they can get the economy going, then we're all going to be happier. But it doesn't necessarily work like that. Until 1950 in my country, in Britain, the economy was not used in any political manifesto. In the last political manifesto by the Conservative Party, which has been in power for most of the time since the Second World War, the economy was used 59 times. No politician would sort of stand up and talk about anything other than making the economy better. And yet, it's my contention, I guess, that that this is a fairly sort of fragile term. It's a term that we don't quite agree on what it means.
So
that we need to delve a little bit deeper to understand what we're talking about.
So why doesn't the world, the UN or something, get together and say, this is how GDP is going to be measured in every country, period? Why don't they do that?
Well, it does. I mean, there is a standardized measure of GDP, and there's a kind of a book called the SNA, which countries are meant to follow. But there are just a number of flaws in GDP. As I mentioned earlier, it was invented in the manufacturing age. It so happens that, you know, we live in economies now, especially rich economies, where services predominate. Services are extraordinarily hard to measure because a lot of what we're measuring is not really the quantity of services that you pump out, but the quality. And when it comes to quality, that's really something that GDP can't grapple with. So, you know, GDP, as I write in my book, is very poor at measuring haircuts, but it's also very poor at measuring landscape gardening or computer services insurance. Or health services,
right.
Or train rides, or an awful lot of things that actually make up.
And you also make a very good point that if I'm going to take a trip to California and I book it online and I take an Uber when I get there and I stay at an Airbnb, that I don't add anything to the GDP. But if I go to a travel agent and book the trip and I stay at a Hilton Hotel, and I take taxi cabs, I tremendously improve the GDP, correct?
Yeah, that's right. I mean, a lot of things are moving out of what we used to measure mm-hmm. and into what we used to call home production. So GDP doesn't measure, you know, if you make your own bed, if you cook your own meal, if you look after your own child or parent, none of that counts as the economy. However, when you used to book, as you said, a flight on an airline or a hotel, you know, use the travel agents. The other day I went to the airport, I tagged my own bag, I took my own bag and put it on the belt and off it went. That would have used to be done by somebody else. That would formerly have been part of the economy. Now suddenly it's moved out of the economy and into what economists call home production. So again, the boundary between what we count as economic activity and what we don't count as economic activity is really quite flimsy. If you think, for example, if you look after your aged relative at home and you can spend a lot of time, you know, giving a lot of quality care, that counts as nothing. That's not part of the economy. However, you send your aged relative to an old people's home and you pay for somebody else to look after them. Suddenly, that's economic activity. So again, I think intuitively, we know that there's something a little bit wrong with that. I mean, clearly you can tax the latter and you can't tax the former, and that is perhaps important to governments. But in terms of what actually kind of human activity is and what we might value, this line between what we count as economic activity and what we don't is much wobblier and vaguer and more sort of discretionary than I think we realize.
And the place that you mentioned, you say Africa, the continent has one billion out of the 7 billion people in the world, and much of the economy is the gray economy.
Well, that's exactly right. You know, somebody showed me a photograph of a market in Nigeria, and, you know, there was tons of activity going on. There were people trading with each other, bartering, selling each other goods, pickpocketing, you know, doing magic tricks, and all sorts of stuff. And none of that is counted as part of the economy. You know, the best you can do is guess at it. And, I mean, for example, and there have been experiments done, you know, by economists, and they use satellite technology to measure nightlights. So if you can conceive of the Korean Peninsula, so you have South Korea at night is ablaze with lights, and North Korea is pretty much darkness because there's no economic activity going on. Now, if you do the same with different economies like India or parts of Africa, what you'll find is that there's much more economic activity going on in the countryside than is picked up by normal methods of measuring the economy. Because the way we normally measure the economy is we go out and we ask people, we say, how much did you spend? How much did you earn? How much did you produce? And, of course, people don't always tell the truth. It's quite hard to get to very remote places, where the satellites spinning over the Earth multiple times a day is able to pick up things like nightlights, which is a kind of proxy for economic activity. So to me, that's slightly strange, this number that we put so much credence in and that we take very seriously in terms of giving aid or lending money to countries or determining how good their economic policy is, can be bettered to some extent by measuring the same thing from outer space.
So,
using satellites.
Right. So one thing, when we come back from the next pause, that I want to talk about is that you can have an incredibly wonderful, magnificent-looking GDP, but there's real trouble under the surface, as we experienced in Iceland and Ireland about 10 years ago. And that will be a topic that we can really dig into and some other many important things.
Absolutely.
So, you know, there's a lot of things going on in GDP, and sometimes it can look really good, but you might have a Ponzi scheme going on.
Sure. Or conversely, look at Japan, and by all measurements, they've been stuck for 25 years.
Yeah.
And yet the quality of life is, and people's standard of living are increasing.
That's true. We got to go to traffic. We'll be right back. Money, Riches, and Wealth. We're talking growth delusion. We'll be back.
This is Drew Tignanelli, host of Money, Riches, and Wealth, and president of the Financial Consulate. Many of you listened to our show for years and thought about coming to meet with us. With every financial physical I do, I wish you would not wait any longer. The mistakes I consistently see are frustrating. I make this offer. Just do a financial physical, and we'll do the complete analysis in two meetings, and you get to go home with the full plan to determine if the physical was worth the cost. If not, absolutely no charge. We do not sell products. We are comprehensive advisors. If your personal finances are in good shape and we add no value, then the financial physical is free. Do not wait. Get a second opinion and just do a financial physical. I am confident you are going to experience something unique and change your tax plan, your retirement plan, your investments, and much more. Call 410-823-SAVE, 410-823-SAVE to schedule your physical, or go online to DrewTig.com. That's DrewTig.com.
I have no idea what that is. Anyway, we're here with Growth Delusion, Dave Pilling, and we're talking about GDP and why it's so important. There are many factors that GDP is used to measure, and as an investor, it's extremely important to understand the good and the bad behind these numbers that we're talking about. And so, David, we were talking about before the break, you know, you have Iceland was doing absolutely fantastic. Everybody was loving life, and same with Ireland. And all of a sudden, 10 years ago, as they're loving life, boom. And, you know, next thing you know, especially the poorer people in the country are just totally devastated. What's happening? Why? How does that happen?
Well, you could argue the same in the U.S. and the same in Britain. I mean, one of the factors was that, you know, GDP, we measure financial services. We measure banking. And the banks were on a sort of a wild spree in the run-up to the 2008 financial crisis. And the way that that figures in GDP, and remember, GDP is really, we often talk about the economy, we talk about growth. These are the same things, basically. The way banks are measured is the riskier they're behaving, the more they figure in GDP. So just before the financial crash and the meltdown of 2008, banks were worth about 10% of U.S. GDP, 10% of U.K. GDP, and the same with those countries you mentioned, Iceland and Ireland. But another way of saying that was that banks were being sort of extraordinarily reckless. And, of course, we all know what happened. You know, we were asked to dip our hands in our pocket to bail them out. And then certainly in Europe, taxes went up. Public services were cut as a result of that. So we were all paying for growth that appeared to be happening in the run-up to the financial crisis, that I would argue was partly an illusion or a delusion of the title of my book. So if we measure things that don't do us any good in the long run, then one could argue, well, why are we measuring them in the first place? And I'll take you back to Kuznets, who thought that financial speculation should not be included in GDP. Just to go back to kind of even the more basics, GDP doesn't measure everything that happens in an economy. It measures what we call the value added. So if you take a loaf of bread, what we're measuring is not the cost of the bread, but we're measuring the value added of the bread. So at each stage, we take out, for example, the flour in the bread and the wheat in the flour. And Kuznets argued that banking was really just an input. It was an input into our production of goods and services, and that we shouldn't really double count banks. But that's exactly what I think we did in the run-up to the financial crisis. So we exaggerated how fast we were growing. And in a sense, we've all been paying for it ever since.
Yeah. You know, I want to go off the topic of your book, but I think it lines up with what you're talking about here. It's something that I've talked about quite often, about money and what money was designed when it was originally created, whatever, 7,000, 10,000 years ago or 100,000 years ago. I don't know. In my opinion, money was created to enhance relationships. Well, relationships are powerful. Money is not. But yet, too many people in today's society are just trying to make money without any benefit to society whatsoever. You know, like you hear about high-frequency traders. You know, people are just trying to make money. You look at what they did during the financial crisis before it and how they were making millions of dollars with no benefit to anyone other than themselves. What do you think?
I would agree with that. I think there is a lot of unproductive activity that shows up in our economy as somehow productive, but we all kind of know that actually, it doesn't really do any of us any good. The only people it might do good are the people who are making money from it. I also do think, and I'm not anti-growth. I'm not some kind of, kind of hippy-dippy guy. But I do think that that we are sort of locked in this rat race where part of what as individuals we're trying to do is just to stay ahead of the next person. So there are people who've done research at the London School of Economics, and for example, one of the economists says, "Look, if you're watching a football match and you're all sat down, and then one person stands up, and then somebody else stands up." And then somebody else stands up because they can't see. And before you know it, the whole stadium is stood up. And they've all got exactly the same view of the football match.
As when they were sitting
they
down.
They don't have the convenience of sitting down. Now, I think intuitively we recognize that that is sort of what we're doing. We're all striving. We're all working harder. It seems every bit as hard to pay our mortgages, to pay our health bills, to pay our school fees. We're working harder and harder, faster and faster, and to what benefit? And sometimes I think we're sort of unwittingly locked in this crazy race.
But how do you share? I mean, that's where it gets complicated. How do you enhance the guy that's working a job that pretty much anyone could do? How do you increase, minimum wage, in my opinion, has its flaws as well as it has what seems to be benefits?
Well, now you're getting, in a sense, onto subjects that are beyond my book, because my book asks a lot of questions. It doesn't necessarily tell you how to create the perfect society.
See, now, if we knew that, David, we might not have had you on the show to begin with, you know?
One of the things that you, I think we're all talking about, and we've said this before, not to change the subject, but to change the subject
here. You just want to get me off topic. Go ahead.
Well, is the quarter-to-quarter, whether it's a company, a country, you look at the quarter-to-quarter growth versus, in his example in here, about the North Sea oil production and what Norway did versus what the UK did. They want you to tell our audience what you're talking about there.
Okay. Well, look, you talk to an investment audience, so you yep. They think about businesses. If you talk about a business, you don't say this business made fantastic profits last quarter. It must be a fantastic business. You also look at its balance sheet. You look at its assets. So a business could make fantastic profits. Mm-hmm. It could sell off all its machinery. It could sack all its workers. And the profits would look fantastic. But the underlying asset base would be terrible, and its ability to make profits in the years ahead would also be terrible. So that's exactly the same thing for nations. You could have an oil-rich nation that's just using up all its oil, and then, hey, presto, all its oil's gone. And it hasn't invested it in anything else, and its economy drops off a cliff. The same with infrastructure. If you're not investing in roads, airports, ports, universities, healthcare, all of that, then what might look like fantastic growth could suddenly decline or even decline dramatically. The same with natural resources. If you have a lot of forests, you chop them all down, then what are you left with? So one of the things I argue in the book is that just as we have for companies and just as we have for individuals when they're trying to get a mortgage, we also need a kind of balance sheet for nations, because that would help us to, or help governments and people to understand better how a country's doing and how a country might do in the future. GDP is very much a backward-looking measure, and some kind of balance sheet measure, as we have, as I say, for companies, would help us to look more about sustainability and look more into the future.
Fearing what the U.S. balance sheet might look like, we're not necessarily in favor of that right now, Ben David. Anyway, we have to take our last pause, but when we come back, Chris and I are sitting in the studios in the great state of Maryland, and you talk about Maryland in your book, which is amazing. We'll find out more about that when we come back for Money, Riches, and Wealth. Take it away, traffic. Oh, I know this one.
David Pilling.
No, I know this band. I can't, I'm Temptated. I'm Tempted. Temptations. There you go. Anyway, we're here with David Pilling, and we're talking Growth Delusion. His book is available on Amazon.com if you want to learn more about GDP and how it's measured and so forth. But, here we are in Maryland, David, and you're talking about the great state of Maryland in your book. I find it amazing. So tell us.
I am indeed. You're pioneers there.
There you are. Well, I know these people down there. Don't call them anything that good. But anyway, go ahead.
So Governor Martin O'Malley.
Oh, no.
I'm sure you'll...
One of our favorites. One of our favorites. Martin, you're our hero. Go ahead.
He introduced something called the GPI, the Genuine Progress Index, which was really an attempt to think about the economy in a different way. And if you remember, I was talking about Kuznets earlier, and he thought that various things should be taken off GDP, our total sort of economic production. And the GPI does exactly that. So, for example, if you build a shopping mall but you destroy a wetland in the process, then GDP would just say that's a plus. But the GPI would try and make some reckoning of that, and it would add something for your mall, but it would take off something for the fact that you've destroyed your wetland. It would do the same for all sorts of other indicators like the quality of jobs, quality of the air,
Couldn't that get political?
Oh, absolutely. But all numbers are political.
Oh, well, that's
one of the points of my book, actually. I mean, I think GDP is a very political number. And so I think that we think that numbers are neutral. But one of the points that I really want to make sort of quite strongly is that they're not. That anything you measure because you think it's good or bad, and therefore you want to kind of screen it out. And so, yes, absolutely, it's political. But I think, you know, to have a debate about what numbers are important and what numbers are not important is vital. So let me sort of broaden this out.
Go ahead.
I think the GPI, in fact, in Maryland, I think one of the things that it adjusts for is sort of equality. So it would look at the distribution of wealth. Now, some people will argue, well, that's not important. You know, if one person's making all the money and everyone else is falling behind, then that's just because that person's cleverer or better or harder working or whatever. And other people would say, no, that's not true. That's because the system's skewed. It's unfair. And those other people have been somehow, you know, disadvantaged. So that's a political debate. I mean, one of the things I would, I mean, I know which side of that debate I'm on. So I would argue that as well as GDP, we should be measuring something like median household income. Which would tell you much more about how the typical person is faring, not just how the super rich or the super poor are faring, but how, you know, your average household. And, of course, we know that in America, typical wages, the median household income, is really stagnated. So you've had a lot of growth in America, but it's gone to, a minority of the population. So I think that we should know that. Some people might say that's fine. Others might say, no, that's not fine, and we need to do something about it.
So now, but you know,
depending on what you measure, that casts light on,
well,
on
let's,
the state.
Let's hold on that U.S. thing, you know, because I hear that, and I've seen that, you know, what you said in the book. But, you know, my circumstantial evidence from growing up in the United States since 1957 says that I don't see any truth to that. What about you, Chris?
Well,
I mean, your circumstantial evidence, Chris, would not say that's true. Because when I grew up, we were pretty moderate or below middle class at the best.
Right.
Middle class at the best.
Right.
And all of my brothers and sisters and a lot of my friends are all significantly better off. And, you know, people I went to school with and so forth and so forth. So I find that interesting that it says that.
But you know that the data tells you that. I mean, from about 1980, median household income has not gone up, particularly if you're have not graduated from college. I mean, I think those.
Well, I guess that's my problem. Is most of the people I know graduated from college?
Yeah, well, you hang out in rarefied circles. I mean, look, something else. So, for example, the American economy has been growing for the last 9 years. The last 2 years, life expectancy in the U.S. has gone down. That's very unusual in advanced economies. Now, you could say, well, that's not important, or you could say, you know, I don't know what.
Well, we're worried about that because what you write about there is that the average Joe, the average white male around 40 to 60 years old, which lines up with Chris and I, are dying dying at a young age, and it's an anomaly that hasn't happened in quite a while, if ever.
Well, you also again have, unfortunately, a lot of people are succumbing to the explosion of opioid usage.
Yeah. So what are you seeing
That's
there?
That's right, and then you need to look at the underlying causes for that. Mm-hmm. I mean, look, but those numbers. You needed Anne Case and Angus Deaton, who won a Nobel Prize. You needed them to do some real sleuthing, investigative work to dig out those numbers. Those numbers were not well known before a few years ago, and it was they that discovered that white working-class Americans were really sort of falling behind. That was not shown up by GDP at all, and in fact, you know, what you were saying earlier, the impression was that everybody was doing just fine. But the truth, if you just dug a little bit below the numbers, was that that was not true.
Well,
and I think that we need to sort of, in a hierarchy of numbers, we need to put some other numbers. We need to give them a little bit more credence and put them a little bit more out in the public view and not just always concentrate on GDP, because I think that will obscure as much as it reveals.
Go ahead.
Sure. Well, no, by all means. But as it's been a static number, they changed the gross domestic product calculation. They tweak it oftentimes. They did, I can't remember, 15, 18 years ago, I remember there was a change. But the economy was slowing, certainly, after, you know, in the 2000s, 2000, 2007, mm-hmm. 2008, before the financial crisis. But then after the crisis, and this is a political statement, but it's really just facts, is the elected president then went on a binge. He didn't really put the economy or jobs at the forefront of his agenda. He put the redistribution of wealth through health care and other things at the top of his agenda. He said he was he cared about jobs, because all politicians have to say that. And so
that's a very big topic for David to answer in 1 minute.
He's talented.
The question is that.
And all that is so. Originally, it's a statement of, you talk about why things have slowed, why people aren't doing as well. Well, we had 8 years. You had that the worst financial crisis in 70 years, and then on top of that, you weren't doing things to help come out of it. So, I mean, that's just to me, that's one perspective on why incomes have stagnated also, and so that's my piece.
Well, I would say that some of the growth that you had in the run-up to 2008 was illusory, and that what you actually needed to do after 2008 was you did need to spend a lot of money. I mean, Congress was stopping some of that spending. I think you needed some kind of old-fashioned Keynesian spending. I basically believe in that. And I think that wasn't done as effectively as it might have been. But, I mean, the American economy is pretty resilient. It did come out of it in the end.
Sure.
Yeah, so, so in conclusion, because we've got about a minute now to do a conclusion here, you know, what's the point that you want our listeners to know about growth delusion, and what can we think about long-term with this topic to help us?
So I would say that when we say the economy, when we say GDP, when we say growth, then listeners should kind of think, yes, but. They should think that tells us some things, but it doesn't tell us everything. It doesn't tell us how sustainable that growth is. It doesn't tell us how it's distributed. It doesn't tell us what the nature of that production is. It could be good production, bad production, or indifferent production. And it's one number, and we should think about some other numbers. In America, you might want to think about life expectancy. If that's going down, then maybe we should worry about why that's going down and think about that seriously. You might want to think about CO2. I'm sure that, and as you say, all numbers are political. I have no objection to that characterization. So, you might want to think about median income. So you might want to think about distribution. There are other things that you can think about as well as just how fast the economy is growing, because that is only telling you one part of the picture.
David Pilling, Growth Delusion. We really appreciate it. He's up at 11 o'clock, 11:50 right now, almost 12 o'clock, hanging out with us. David, I really appreciate your time. We're out of time ourselves. And this is Drew Tignanelli saying God bless.